From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Active shooter situations are, by nature, unpredictable and evolve quickly. That's the first observation officials with the Department of Homeland Security make before offering what tools and resources they have. In many cases, DHS officials say there is no pattern or method to the selection of victims by an active shooter. According to the New York Times, on average, there have been about 5 school shootings each month since 2014. That includes episodes not classified as mass shootings. The year of the massacre at Columbine High School in Colorado, just 19% of schools said they used security cameras to monitor buildings. By 2016, 83% had installed cameras at school, according to USA Today. It's tomorrow. If you're listening to the live Wednesday edition, that New Hanover County Commissioners convene a roundtable on school safety. The purpose of the roundtable, according to a press release, to discuss the current plan for school safety, how the county's mental health resources are being integrated across schools, and what opportunities for improvement or policy gaps exist that need to be addressed. Because this larger public conversation around school safety and gun violence is evolving in many communities, WHQR is producing a series of discussions on the issue of gun safety and gun violence over the coming weeks, in a commitment to facilitate a full public discussion addressing not just school safety, but other facets of the gun conversation. The first installment in this series is specifically focused on school safety and security. In future discussions, we hope to include parents, students, local leaders, and a diverse cross-section of the community. Today's exploration we'll undertake in segments. First, we're going to hear from the Wilmington Police Department about a training program offered at no cost by WPD to facilities that are not public schools, such as daycare facilities, churches, private schools. Public Information Officer Linda Thompson was scheduled to join us today, but she is attending the funeral of retired Captain George Perkins after his unexpected passing over the weekend. I'd like to extend deepest condolences on behalf of WHQR to the family, friends, and colleagues of Captain Perkins. Here in Linda Thompson's place, I'm very glad to welcome communications specialist Jennifer Dandrin of the Wilmington Police Department. Welcome to Coastline, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
And we're inviting your questions on this Wednesday. In the wake of the Florida school shooting, have you started to think differently about school safety? You can call us during this live Wednesday edition at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Jennifer Dandrin, the Wilmington Police Department is offering this free training program for private schools, daycare facilities, and other places not covered by public school protocols. Are you seeing an interest in this program since the Parkland shooting earlier this month?
Absolutely. Initially, we had just limited the seminar to daycares and child care centers. But in light of the Parkland shooting, we decided it was very important to open it up to more than just that, and our numbers skyrocketed. This is obviously a need in the community. People want to know what to do to be safe. Although the threat of an active shooter is rare, it is very real, and people know that.
Now, we're going to talk in a moment about the ALICE protocol, and that is an acronym that contains 5 steps. But first, in addition to this ALICE training protocol, what else does the Wilmington Police Department offer local folks, institutions, organizations that are not public schools in terms of helping with greater security?
Well, at the seminar on Tuesday, which you still have time to sign up for, we'll have the ALICE presentation. We'll have a retired sergeant going over the law enforcement response, so you know what to expect once law enforcement gets there. And we'll also have a SEPTED presentation, which is crime prevention through environmental design. So that will teach you how to use your layout, how to use your property to protect and prevent yourself. In addition to that, without the seminar, people can call and get free assessments of their property. We have a crime prevention specialist on staff who will walk through your property with you and give you recommendations of how to make your property safer.
Maybe talk about areas of the property that might be vulnerable.
Right, absolutely. And we'll we can also provide you with light recommendations, lock recommendations, ways to really just make your place safer without limiting your mission.
Now let's talk about this ALICE training. The ALICE Institute studied national shootings that happened, and based on those shootings, they say that if institutions or people implemented some of their strategies, maybe that would cut down on the number of victims.
Right. So ALICE is really focused on the civilian response and how to save your life. And every second counts in a violent intruder situation, because sometimes it's not an active shooter. Sometimes it's something else where someone is threatening your campus, and it's focused on ways to keep you safe and get you out of the building.
Now, the five ALICE steps are alert, lockdown, inform, counter, evacuate. So let's start with alert. What does that mean?
So when you are alerted, that refers to the moment you become aware of the situation that you're in. The sooner that you can accept that you're in danger, the sooner you can start trying to save your life and the lives of those around you. Some people have a little denial when it comes to it. It can be startling, for, you know, lack of a better word, to find out that you're in a building that has an active shooter. But sitting there and hoping that that's not true isn't going to save your life. You know, accept that you're in that position and then take the steps to get out safely.
Now, we know that drills are a hugely important part of this. People can establish the best protocol in the world, but if they can't execute it, it's not going to help anyone. Do you think that that first step, that just the recognition that there's a situation, is one of the harder steps for people to kind of take?
Absolutely. People don't want to be in that situation. So if you can, you know, denial is strong. And unfortunately, in those moments of hesitation, you're losing vital seconds of saving your life. But so in that moment, the moment you accept that's happening, you can go ahead and start implementing those protocols. And we see that, you know, people will have protocols, we'll help them write them, we'll go over your protocols with you, but it means nothing if you can't go through with it.
There was an incident yesterday, if you're listening to this live Wednesday show. Tell us what happened with St. Mary's Catholic School and why that is a particularly, it's a little bit different because it's not structured the way a traditional public school is structured.
Right. So at St. Mary's Catholic School, it's a pretty open campus, and there were two men on the campus, or in one of the buildings of the campus that is generally open to the public, and they got into a confrontation, and one of the men pulled out a gun and attempted to shoot the other. Fortunately, his weapon malfunctioned and was not, and there was no damage to anyone. But in that situation, it was scary because there are children on that campus and there are other people of the public on that campus, and there were witnesses who saw everything happen. So in those instances, when your campus is open to the public, you're inviting a little bit more danger than just having, you know, limited access.
And so lockdown is the second step. Now, in that case, were St. Mary's school officials able to lock down the kids and make sure the rest of the student body was safe?
Well, I can't speak to what St. Mary's protocol is or what they implemented, but with the lockdown for ALICE, it's in that instance that you can't evacuate, which is what we recommend. If you can, the safest thing you can do is to leave the environment, barricade whatever room you're in, and trying to make your environment as secure as possible. You're not going to be able to barricade it so securely that someone can't get in, but try and do your best with it. So if it takes propping a door underneath your, or propping a chair under your door handle, or putting something big against the door so you have a harder time breaking into it, that's what the lockdown is referring to.
And then we get to inform, the I in ALICE. And who are we informing here?
That's a good question. So you need to inform 911, but you also need to inform the other people in your building. So if an incident is happening in a west wing, you need to inform the people in the East Wing or in the lobby or other parts of the building. And so when you create your emergency response plan, you also need to include how you will inform those people, whether it's sending out a text message, going over the PA system, because once you can inform others, they can start, you know, accepting that they're also in this position and they can do the alert part of ALICE. So with the inform, you need to communicate with us. So call 911.
Now, is that the first step or is it informing other people on the premises first? Which should come first?
That's a good question. You should have a designated person to call 911 in that instance. And when you do your emergency response plan, have that person designated. Make sure they know that is their responsibility. And be confident that if you're in that situation, the person will do that. So you don't have to worry about it.
Okay. And then we get to counter.
So counter is a last resort strategy. We don't want you to be a sitting duck. So if you are in that situation and a violent intruder comes into your room, do whatever you can to distract him and to create an unstable environment for him, whether it's throwing, you know, a stapler that you have on your desk or creating noises, anything to get the intruder off balance. Because if they aren't focused, if they have that environment of a distraction, they're less likely to hit a target.
And then we get to evacuate. Tell us again about the date and the time for this upcoming training event for anyone who can come. This is free.
Right. This is a free event on March 6th, Tuesday from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Lumina Theater in the Fisher Student Center on UNCW's campus.
Great. Thank you. And we'll post that on our website, too. Jennifer Dandron of the Wilmington Police Department, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. When we come back from this break, we'll meet the Deputy Superintendent of New Hanover County Schools and a professor who specializes in at-risk students. We want to hear from you today. If you have a question, call us during the live Wednesday discussion, 910-343-1111. Or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're continuing the public discussion on school shootings, violence, and safety, what researchers already know about prevention, and how local schools are handling the prospect of an active shooter. Joining us now, Jana Robertson is a professor in the Department of Instructional Technology, Foundations, and Secondary Education at the Watson College of Education at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She is co-coordinator of the UNCW Dropout Prevention Coalition and served on the Safer Schools Task Force. Jana Robertson, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you.
Rick Holliday is the Deputy Superintendent of New Hanover County Public Schools. Welcome to the program, Rick Holliday.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And we're inviting your questions and concerns during this live Wednesday discussion. What do you want to know about school protocols? What concerns do you have? You can either call us during this live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. It's reasonable to conclude that the public conversation after this most recent school shooting in Florida is changing the way Americans are talking about Second Amendment rights, about what that means, and the way policymakers of all political stripes are talking about moving forward. How has Parkland, Florida changed the conversation locally for the schools, Rick Holliday?
Interestingly enough, and sadly enough, we have had very similar situations occur after every one of the major school shootings going back to Columbine. And every time we take that time to look at what we're doing and to make sure that we're doing everything that we can to make sure that our schools are safe. But one of the most concerning things that happens after one of these events is all of the the threats that we get, that some people think that it's appropriate to do or it's fun to do, and it winds up costing a child, usually a middle school child or a high school child. It winds up costing them and their parents a lot of money, them some, maybe even some jail time, and it then impacts their ability to go on to the next level, whether it be work or college or what have you. That becomes a real tragedy. And what we're trying to do is to educate our parents and our students that making those threats, because you might think, well, we'll get out of school for a few hours or we'll get out of school for a day or whatever, is going to cost you a whole lot more than you ever wanted to pay for it. And that is the main concern about these instances, because quite frankly, I believe that our schools, with the partnerships that we have, are as safe as they've ever been. But that doesn't mean we can't be safer and we can't take a look at what we're doing. But we have wonderful partners. I mean, the Sheriff's Department, the Police Department have been great partners over the years. Sheriff McMahon was actually my SRO when I was an assistant principal out at Laney 1,000 years ago. So we've kind of come up through the ranks together. So that partnership with the Sheriff's Department has been really good. We have good partnerships with DSS and emergency management and all the folks here. And without that, we couldn't do it.
And it's always challenging, certainly, these copycat right. kinds of incidents. Right. And, of course, you have to follow up on everything.
Everything.
Jana Robertson, it's understandable. I mean, this is what kids do. Their brains aren't fully formed. Even the best kids don't always have great judgment. How, as someone who specializes in dealing with at-risk kids, is there a way that educators or school officials or parents or the community can help to kind of counteract that post-tragedy, sort of all those false alarms that then happen? Because the kid, is it an attention-seeking thing?
Sometimes it is attention-seeking when they see, you know, we all take responsibility because we put it on the media, we broadcast about the offenders, sometimes more than the victims, and we kind of make them stars. So why wouldn't you want to, you know, be part of that if it gets you a lot of attention, especially if it's somebody who's not getting it in appropriate ways or as much as they'd like. But I do want to back up what Dr. Holliday said, in that one of the safest places to send your child every day is school. So when we hear these things, we all panic and we all worry. And I just want to reiterate that even though I have spent years examining what makes schools safer, what makes them unsafe is our society, not schools. Okay, I mean, or some of the things that we're doing in general. These children who are acting out, that's just actually typical adolescent or pre-adolescent behavior, but we've now criminalized it, and we have had to, because sometimes it's led to deadly outcomes.
And you said that we make often the perpetrator a star, a media star. And I think that the overriding reason that we do that is because we want to understand who this person was and what happened and how they reached that point where, you know, in this case, Nicholas Cruz killed 17 people with an AR-15. How did we get there? And so, can you look at what you know about Nicholas Cruz and say, well, these are all the points he fell through the cracks? And I'm not talking about the alerts to law enforcement. That's beyond the scope of what we're here to discuss. We're talking about schools, school officials, parents, the community with kids.
Well, one of the factors in a recent study that came out that besides most of the children or even young adults who have perpetrated these mass murders were not only mostly white, mostly male, they also were missing fathers in a lot of the cases, 73%, they said. And I haven't delved into that data. It's a fairly recent study, but it shows that, again, it's not a school issue. This breakdowns in family or supports is something that happens outside. The schools, there's a lot of things that schools can do to try to ameliorate that and help with it, but it didn't start there.
Rick Holliday, when you look at the notion of school safety and security, What does that mean? I mean, when you look at the webpage of the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction, it's a whole bunch of things beyond cameras and beyond locked doors. How do you create a safe environment in New Hanover County schools?
It takes work, and it takes money, and it takes time, and it takes a lot of talent. It's become a field unto itself, basically. I recall, like I've said, and I can't underscore enough, we get great support from the Sheriff's Department. But I recall my first instance with a school resource officer when I was assistant principal at Laney High School back in the early 90s. Sheriff Joe McQueen, who was the sheriff at that time, showed up at our building, and he said, "Mr. Holliday, here's your SRO." And I said, I didn't even know what an SRO was, but he was a guy with a sheriff uniform on, and he was a nice guy, and he worked with us. No particular training, just a sheriff deputy that was assigned to my school. Now the SROs have to undergo an extensive amount of training before they're put into schools. We have in our school system a safety officer that is in charge of safety for the school district. You wouldn't think a school district back in the early 90s or late 80s would have a safety officer that was primarily looking for making sure that we had closed all the doors that we needed to, making sure that our schools were safe. But we have that now. We're also have extensive mental health in our schools, because that is the other piece of it that Dr. Robertson was talking about just a few moments ago. Trying to understand and make sense out of what makes someone want to do that. And she's exactly right in that our society has gotten to the point that that kind of behavior is manifesting. And how do you understand it? We have to understand it every day, and we have to have people in our buildings that are trained to be able to deal with that. And we do. But if you were to ask me 25 years ago, would we have needed that? I would have thought no. But today, we can't get along without it.
We have an email from Amy who writes, "Let's look at Hoggard High School. When I drop my child at school, there are children entering from all different sides and streets, hundreds of kids in and around school at 8:15. I see the same school officer walking into the school at the same time every day." She writes, "It would take one child, I think, a few minutes to kill dozens of children. This repeats at the end of the day. This is without the gunned individual entering the building. During the day, someone could enter the front door, get to a classroom, kill dozens before they could be stopped. My child says she looks for escape routes while in class, but says they feel trapped like a fish in a bowl for shooters." Rick Holliday, do you have a response to that? This is part of the way that Nicholas Cruz accomplished his.
Absolutely. One of the things that that we're looking at is we've got three campuses. It's just not just Hoggard, because Laney is designed similarly. And New Hanover, which, of course, was built in 1919, is designed in a very unique way in that it has a thoroughfare through its campus. It has Market Street running right through its campus. These are particular challenges to us, especially when you have a school that has multiple buildings and multiple access points. It's not that we have forgotten that or we don't understand that. We understand it every day. And the problem is the school is designed in such a way that we change classes every 90 minutes in high school, which means there are 2,000 kids moving from one place to the next. What we would have to figure out is how to secure each building in between classes, and there are ways that we can do that. We're looking at ways to do that, but can you keep those doors locked all day, not without changing classes, not without 2,000 children moving from one place to the next? And on Dr. Robertson's campus over there, they've got the same problem. You have multiple buildings spread out over a vast territory. And that would be difficult to take care of completely. There are things that we can do that we're looking at, and we're examining, can we program the doors to lock, and can we release those locks during class changes, and then what would happen between class changes? So every solution you come up with a different problem.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of the practices and protocols, what we know around school security and how to keep students safe. Here to answer your questions on this Wednesday, Rick Holliday, Deputy Superintendent of New Hanover County Public Schools, and Jana Robertson, Professor in the Department of Instructional Technology, Foundations, and Secondary Education at UNCW's Watson College of Education. In just a moment, Professor Robertson, I want to hear from you about the conclusions from the Safer Schools Task Force. But first, Jennifer from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. Initially, I did have a question, really probably more appropriately to Jana, who I know has worked on violence in schools and other things like that. But having the opportunity to have Dr. Holliday, I want to ask him, he was talking about how much work it is to keep a school safe every day. I couldn't agree more. But I'm curious about the work that was happening when he was the principal at Laney High School and met Mike Kelly for the first time, a chemistry teacher at Isaac Bear. And I wonder if he can tell us about his experience with him and say something to the parents of this school, including myself, about the situation that we're in now with our children.
All right. Thank you so much for your question, Jennifer. Rick Holliday.
I can't address anything about that this time.
And she is referring to the recent arrest of someone who is accused of sexual abuse of children, which is certainly a legitimate element of school safety. But today the focus of the discussion is on guns and school safety and how we're dealing with some of these kids who escalate into what Nicholas Cruz did on February 14th. Jana Robertson, tell us about this Safer Schools Task Force that you participated in and that ended in 2013. You have a list of recommendations.
Basically, Chief Judge Corpening and District Attorney Ben David convened a very comprehensive group of us from law enforcement, the schools, but also mental health and social services, because we really wanted to focus in on preventative, not just intervention. And the recommendations, well, the first one, Dr. Holliday already addressed about physical safety, and Dave Spencer from the district went through a huge protocol where a lot of people had to examine each campus. And if you notice, ever since then, you can't get on an elementary school or middle school unless you can be buzzed in. So the high schools are still a challenge, but there's been a lot of changes. There's also programs, process.
And, sorry, just on that point, in most of those schools, not the high schools, but is there one entry point?
Yes.
So a visitor has to go through this one main door and get buzzed in. Okay.
Absolutely. The ones that I'm going to focus a little bit more are on personnel and programs and process. Oh, sorry, I went into the P thing when I did
that's
this.
Okay. The four P's, which is part of this conclusion.
Okay,
yes.
Right. So first of all, in terms of personnel, one of the strongest and weakest areas of schools is, do we have enough people and do we have the right people and are they well-trained? There is amazing mental health services, as Dr. Holliday said, in New Hanover County Schools versus other school districts, except that I would still say, regardless of how many resources they put into it, their school psychologists have caseloads that are ridiculously large, so are the social workers as well as the counselors. Not any fault of the school district. There's just not enough funds. The teachers need training. The school resource officers, obviously, as Dr. Holliday said, needed a lot of training in this too. And one of the issues isn't even just personnel. It's that you train them, but then there's new hires and people leave. So it's an ongoing process of making sure you have well-trained support staff and faculty. But I will say New Hanover has done all the recommendations that were made, they have tried to follow. The even a larger accomplishment, I would say, was some of the process. Multi-tiered system of support, and I'm sorry to get all jargon on you for a second, is something that's become statewide, where there's levels of supports that we do for all students to improve school climate, and then there's ones we have that are more targeted for those who are having behavioral or academic problems, for that matter, and then there's more intensive supports for those who have actual behavioral problems and need some intensive interventions. And then when it comes to programs, I've been very proud of the local school districts in using evidence-based programs that have worked across the country and that they are continually adding and improving those.
We look at the Parkland, Florida case again, and Jana Robertson, as part of the Dropout Prevention Coalition created in 2011 to raise awareness of the magnitude of the high school dropout problem in southeastern North Carolina, that was lifted specifically from the page, which talks about this Dropout Prevention Coalition. What is the magnitude of the problem here, and is that a step on the pathway towards someone becoming a Nicholas Cruz?
Well, I'll tell you what's ironic. You know how we keep hearing about all the things that are wrong with the schools? Do you know that graduation rates right now are the highest they've ever been ever since we've had America? Okay, I mean, absolutely phenomenal. But no one talks about that. Okay, now someone will say, but those are phony. Those people aren't really being trained. Well, maybe if that's true for a few. But I say right now, if we step away from the horror, the schools are doing an amazing job in that students are graduating, and we have the lowest unemployment rate ever. So, you know, or at least recent years, I guess we can go back to the 70s and it was higher. But
this phrase, the magnitude of the high school dropout problem in southeastern North Carolina, you don't think that applies anymore?
No, I think until it's 100%, I'm not happy. Okay, but it's 85%, and that's pretty good.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're learning about how local public schools are dealing with the evolving conversation around school safety, particularly after the recent Florida shooting. Rick Holliday, Deputy Superintendent of New Hanover County Public Schools, and Jana Robertson, professor at UNCW's Watson College of Education, are answering your questions. After this break, you'll have one more segment to get your question in on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're continuing the conversation ignited by the recent Parkland, Florida school shooting in which 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz murdered 17 people with an AR-15. Today's conversation is specifically focused on school security and what that means beyond security cameras and locked doors. Here to answer your questions on this Wednesday, Jana Robertson, professor in the Department of Instructional Technology, Foundations, and Secondary Education at UNCW's Watson College of Education, and Rick Holliday, Deputy Superintendent with New Hanover County Public Schools. If you have a question for our guests, you can call us during the live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so you have just a few minutes to get your own question in. We have an email from Anonymous who writes, "Last year, I tried calling into Forest Hills Elementary late one morning to alert staff that a little boy had walked away from the building, apparently unseen by school personnel. We stopped him down the block and kept him safe, but I had to call and call before I could reach someone at the school. It took several minutes. You could not try another extension unless you knew individual extensions. This matched my own experience when my child attended school," this person writes. "If someone happens not to be at the front desk, it can be difficult to figure out how to reach someone else. It occurred to me at the time that had I been trying to warn them of a shooter approaching the building, it could have been all the more tragic. What are we doing to make it easier to alert schools of incoming threats? The phone systems we have in place could be a problem." Rick Holliday.
Well, we're always going to have situations that might not be the best. And this situation I remember very well, because we dealt with it We hope that we will have people on the phones that can answer the phones. We will probably have more communication tools than we've ever had. Somebody doesn't have to be sitting by the phone. They can. We have mobile phones and those kinds of things. Usually those kinds of occurrences, I would like to believe, are anomalies, things that we can address very easily, which we did in that particular case. We hope that things like that won't happen often. But I can tell you very clearly that when you're dealing with human beings, you're going to have human issues. And we train our staff in making sure that all of our safety protocols are followed, but it only takes one situation to make it not work. And that's in anything that we do, not just in our schools, but everywhere we go. And since we are the public schools, everyone gets to come to us. We don't make determinations as to who comes and who doesn't. So we deal with everything, the good and the not so good things, aspects of our society. So we have to be particularly careful. And also because we are public, it's very easy to know exactly what happens in our buildings. You may not know in some other schools that may not be public what happens, but you certainly know in ours, and we're very, very open as to when those things occur.
And Deputy Superintendent Rick Holliday, I want to get your reaction. Amy writes in, "This conversation is so frustrating." She writes, "Holliday admits that we can't keep the kids safe, saying you solve one problem and you find another." She writes, "It should not be his problem to solve. We can't create a fortress. We shouldn't have to spend valuable dollars trying. You can't ignore the gun problem." She says, "I wish I heard some real concern and intensity out of these school administrators. Parents and kids are mad. They should be too." Are you mad?
Well, let me tell you what. You may not be hearing the intensity in my voice, but understand that's all I think about, and that's all I've done for the past several years. And I would like to think that I could think about teaching and learning once in a while. But in this role, I spend the bulk of my time worrying about the children of this community and our staff members. And anyone who knows me knows that. I don't, this is certainly not about me because I'm an old man and I have had my career and I understand that, but my phone does not get within a couple of feet of me even when I'm asleep because I'm apt to get a call in the middle of the night with an issue that I need to deal with before school starts the next day. That's what I signed up for. I'm not complaining because that's what I signed up for. But I don't – any insinuation that we're not worried about this constantly and it not keeping us awake at night and consuming us all day long is just simply false.
Do you think that this is tied into that larger conversation about how we deal with guns in our culture? Is that – are you – as Amy suggests, are you having to deal with a problem that is really larger than the schools?
Every problem that we deal with in the public schools is a problem in our society, period. Dr. Robertson was absolutely correct. We are, like the wise old teacher once said a long time ago, whosoever will, let him come. We are just like that. We are in that business. We don't get to say, let's keep this problem out or keep these problems out and let's let all the good stuff in. Whatever the children bring is what we get, and we have to address those concerns and those needs. The thing also that Dr. Robertson hit the nail on the head on is when you look at these instances of mass violence in our schools, they're occurring in places that generally, as a community, we think are safe. These are suburban schools. These are high socioeconomic schools. I mean, look at Columbine. Columbine was a prime example of this. This school in Florida was very similar. And we don't expect those kind of, everyone thinks that that schools that are located in certain neighborhoods might be the least safe. And that's not always true because we don't know what's going to come from the outside in or what's going on all the time with some of our children. Yes, you're exactly right. They might have missed a lot of the situations going on with that student in Florida, But the truth of the matter is every child who doesn't have a father or every child who's been in that particular situation doesn't go do what this child did. And we've got to figure out what made this child do what he did based on his circumstances.
And Professor Robertson, I want to get to you in just a moment. Daniela writes, as a graduate of New Hanover County Schools, I feel confident our school leadership teams are doing the very best they can to ensure the safety of our schools. She asks, what do you think about the research that illustrates zero tolerance policies in schools increase the chances of school violence?
Well,
I'm going to say something about that when you're done.
Okay. Unfortunately, when we put a lot of law enforcement in the schools and started zero tolerance policies, the purpose was to keep our students safe. Instead, we started criminalizing nonviolent behaviors, misdemeanors. This isn't about New Hanover County Schools, but just nationally, cell phone violations or dress codes. I mean, all of a sudden, Judge Korpening had a full courthouse, of things that, like, why am I seeing this? This should get detention.
Right.
And so since then, we have worked very hard. We have a model program here in New Hanover County Schools called the Interagency Agreement, which has cut the school-to-prison pipeline in half, and it's now a model for the state. So there's a lot of people here who have been working on this ever since.
And this is an agreement that came out of the work of
the Safer Schools Task Force. Mm-hmm. One of the recommendations. Zero tolerance makes no sense because there's no standardized child and there's no homogeneic group. I don't think someone dealing drugs should be treated like a child bringing an aspirin accidentally. I don't think a butter knife is at the same level as a machete. Okay, so zero tolerance had no nuance. And I do think true effective interventions need to take the situation and the child into consideration.
Deputy Superintendent Rick
Holliday. There are no more zero tolerance policies. By law, there are no more zero tolerance policies. We treat every child the same. We don't treat every child the same with depending upon what they do. If, like Dr. Robertson said, there is a distinct difference between a kid bringing an aspirin and a kid trying to sell drugs. And even the kid selling drugs, you're going to deal with what actually occurred in that particular case. There are certain things that a child might do that might ordinarily get a certain punishment, but the principal still has discretion over what to do. There are no longer any zero tolerance policies.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of the practices and protocols around school security and student safety, how that conversation is evolving. With us today, Rick Holliday, Deputy Superintendent of New Hanover County Public Schools, and Jana Robertson, Professor at UNCW's Watson College of Education. We have a question via email from Jennifer. She writes, often we hear after the fact, oh, I knew I didn't say anything. Or from students who had a hunch. We've seen reports from Parkland that time after time the shooter gave signals or warnings that the SRO knew this was a person to be watched and he was missed. Jennifer asks, I'm curious to know what processes are in place both from an SRO perspective, WPD perspective, NHCS, and mental health, both in the schools and the county, to not only prevent an incident but to catch a student before they get to the point of wanting to do something so catastrophic? And why isn't there more funding from a county level to help the mental health support at the schools? Jana Robertson.
Well, first of all, there's a new initiative happening at New Hanover County Schools that I'm very happy to say was approved by Dr. Holliday and his whole staff to do. It actually started years ago, this program, after actually 9/11. But it was See Something, Say Something. Because even though there's been several programs like Rachel's Challenge went through every single school in New Hanover County Schools where they learned about the Columbine incident and learned that's where a lot of kindness clubs and things like that were started in the last few years. But the See Something, Say Something addresses everything from teachers acting inappropriately to bullying to it means we're all bystanders. We're all bystanders and we should be involved and care. And I know right now the community is feeling like, what can I do? What can I do? And feeling really hopeless. Well, this See Something, Say Something, I'm hoping is for parents to say something and community members to say something, church members. You know, there's a lot of people who interact with our children. And the research has overwhelmingly always shown that a one-to-one relationship with a caring adult is the number one thing that we can do to make sure these things don't happen. If there's one person who really cares about every child out there, hopefully more than one, but I'm going to go with the minimum here, and if they see something, they say something, then all these wonderful interventions that we have and the ones we're trying to get can actually be implemented.
We have a question from Brandon of Wilmington. Brandon says, Texas has a school marshal program. Do you know how this program works and could it be effective? Is that similar to SROs?
I've never heard of the school marshals program. We have, of course, we met with our high school principals the other day with some of our sheriff department partners, and one of the things that we were talking with our high school and middle school principals about is that we have a larger SRO force in the New Hanover County schools than most communities have police forces. The average size of the average police force in North Carolina is 17 members. In New Hanover County schools, we have an SRO force, which includes our supervisors, of close to 40. So we feel like we have as good a presence of law enforcement, and those are trained law enforcement. Like Dr. Robertson said, they're not there to arrest kids. They're there to provide safety and security. Every once in a while, sadly enough, they might have to arrest a kid, but that's not what they're there for. They're there to provide safety and security and to provide and be role models for the children that are there, and they do an excellent job with that.
One of the ideas out of the Safer Schools Task Force was to make being an SRO a respectable and reasonable career path, Jana Robertson.
I don't know if I can speak to exactly what's happening now, but I will say when we wrote this, there was a bizarre kind of phenomenon where you would go be a school resource officer and build all those relationships in that school and really get to know the children and mentor and all that. And then if you wanted promotion, you had to go back out on the streets for a while before you could get promoted to the next rank. So one of our suggestions was that, why couldn't you go be the ultimate school resource officer and have that be a totally valid career path? Because we do have some gifted SROs in this community who do much more than just keep the school safe. They also are one more adult who has a really tight relationship with many children, sometimes the children who need it the most.
Which sounds like the ideal SRO. You think about that story, I think it happened last year when an SRO in a South Carolina public school got into an altercation with a female, a teenager, who had a cell phone. And again, this is something that you might say, well, perhaps she deserved detention. She shouldn't have been grabbed out of her chair and thrown to the ground like this. And this is one of the concerns I think that parents reasonably can have. How are SROs trained?
Well,
why did that happen?
I can't speak to why that happened, because I would hope that it wouldn't happen here. Our last two SRO commanders, our longtime SRO commander, Lieutenant Novella Freelander, who was absolutely wonderful, was an SRO, started as an SRO and became the commander of the unit, and was an example of someone who was promoted through the ranks. Our sergeants that we have currently now have been SROs. Our commander, Lieutenant Brown, was one of my SROs out at Laney again 1,000 years ago. So these guys have come up through the ranks, and we're really proud of the work that they do.
And that's this edition of Coastline, and we'll look forward to continuing this conversation as the issue evolves. Rick Holliday, Jana Robertson, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Jennifer Dandron with the Wilmington Police Department. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Caitlin Hanrahan was today's chief engineer. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster and today's call screener. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org, get the podcast, or find it on the WHQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.